we start our meeting. We have lots of visitors and lots of staff. There must be something interesting on the agenda. Let's take a look. Oh, insurance. I give the floor to Andrea.
So good morning, everyone. The papers for this meeting cover a number of topics, and in particular, the level of aggregation. And together with the board meetings over the last few months, this means that at the end of this meeting, we'll have discussed each of the 25 topics that were identified to you at the October meeting. And so I'd like to take a few moments now to outline our next steps after this meeting. We might still have further technical topics to discuss with you, for example, consequential issues arising from your decisions so far, or some issues identified as we draft the exposure draft. But we will have largely finished the substantive deliberations for an exposure draft at this meeting. So that means that our expectation is that at the April meeting, we're going to ask you to consider an overview of all the amendments to be proposed in the exposure draft, together with an assessment of those amendments against the criteria that you agreed back in October. And under the assumption that you're happy with that analysis, we propose to ask for permission to begin the balloting process for an exposure draft at that same meeting. We will simultaneously be seeking permission from the DPOC for a shorter comment period than the standard 120 days to reflect both the focused nature of the proposed amendments and the urgency of finalising any amendments in time for entities to apply any revised IFRS 17 for annual periods beginning on or after 1st of January 2022. I'd also like to note that while it's possible that further implementation issues could arise, so far, we expect that any further issues are unlikely to lead to standard setting at this stage. And this is because we expect that by now, all the substantive issues should have been identified in the 22 months since IFRS 17 was issued. And we recognise that further changes to IFRS 17 could disrupt rather than aid implementation efforts. And so with that, I'd like to begin discussions for the first topic of this meeting and pass over to Anne.
Thank you. So we've developed three papers on the level of aggregation. Agenda papers 2B and 2C are for information only and give detailed background on the IFRS 17 requirements and their rationale and a history of the board's decisions and feedback on those decisions. Agenda paper 2A sets out the staff analysis of stakeholder concerns and implementation challenges and includes a recommendation for the board, which is to retain the requirements in IFRS 17 unchanged. Paper 2A explains that the requirements in IFRS 17 strike a balance between three things. So there's two related to information, which is the need for some aggregation of contracts to provide useful information about insurance activities, but the need also to avoid too high a level of aggregation to avoid loss of information about trends in the entity's profits from insurance contracts, timely recognition of profit on profitable contracts so that all the profit has been recognised by the end of the coverage period, and timely recognition of losses on onerous contracts. And then the third point that we need to balance is the operational burden for entities who are providing this information. Consistently with the feedback the board heard during the development of IFRS 17, some stakeholders have expressed concern with the level of aggregation requirements in IFRS 17, mainly relating to the annual cohort. Some stakeholders think that the requirements will not provide users of financial statements with useful information, that the implementing the requirements is a major challenge and the benefits do not outweigh the costs, and the requirements are unnecessary because an entity can achieve the same outcome without applying the requirements. The paper provides examples of why the staff think the requirements in IFRS 17 do provide useful information and why they're necessary. One of the examples considers variable fee approach contracts that share returns on underlying items across different generations of policyholders. Some stakeholders have said that the annual cohort requirement is particularly distorting for these contracts. However, the staff analysis demonstrates, we think, that the requirements in IFRS 17 appropriately depict the sharing of the policyholder's share of the returns on underlying items across generations, but also the fact that the entity share of the returns created by the contracts varies over time. The staff think that the information about timely recognition of profits and losses and trends in profitability is a key benefit of IFRS 17. We acknowledge there will be costs in providing this information, but we note that IFRS 17 already includes practical simplifications, like the use of annual cohorts, because of feedback received that a more principle-based approach, say based on similar profitability, would be unduly burdensome. So I hand it over to the board to discuss.
Anne?
Thank you, Anne, and thank you, team, for the papers.
I agree with the proposal, the question put to us on page 17, that the aggregation requirements remain unchanged from IFRS 17. I do appreciate that this is a fundamental issue for the industry and that there are many concerns they have raised with us, and they're not new. They've been raised for a long time. And I appreciate that you've given them consideration in the material that you've presented to us. So I do understand that the industry's preference is for financial reporting that looks different to what we're going to see under IFRS 17. But on balance, I think that the contribution of IFRS 17 requires a new way of reporting that is more transparent for investors and does allow for them to see the time trends, which I think is what you've mentioned, Anne, in your tee-up. So although it's a big change for the industry, so obviously creates costs for them, on balance, I think that the benefits for investors that will flow from using this standard justify us not changing aggregation requirements.
Thank you. Thank you. I also agree with staff's recommendation. Although I understand the reasons shown in the paragraph 9 to 12 not to do that, but I still think having annual cohort is somehow optimal, compromise. And having said that, I have a strong concern with the practical difficulty and the cost for doing this, especially the method shown in the example A here in this paper. And actually, our standard B70 says you can have a different practical approach to be used. And also BC 138 says that the requirement specifies amount to be reported, but not the methodology. So showing the example here is very good. However, we have to emphasize that this is not the best and the only way to have a calculation of, especially for the mutualization. So that is very important. And also, I have a concern with the practical difficulty of transfer of cash flow between the groups. And in this example, it says you have to make a transfer of cash flow from group one to group two. However, many insurers says it is quite difficult to track such an artificial cash flow because this is not actual cash flow. So there might be some other ways. Just let me, can I ask some questions on the, precise questions on the table shown in page 21, table 8? In this table 8, free cash flow of group 2 is 14 and 85.
Would it be in fact easier to look at the table on page 13 because it's got a comprehensive
page 13.
It's got a comprehensive set of all the numbers.
Okay,
so if you're
trying
to pull
easier.
Out points, it's
so
probably
then, so
easier.
In the column D, group 2 says group 2's free cash flow is 14,855. And then it says, if you go to the, again, you need to go to page 21.
Sorry.
So the reason why it was calculated is because the cash flow of 906 was transferred. So therefore,
906 was transferred from column C to column D in page 3. And so that means you need to calculate the cash flow of 906. But insurer has multiple contracts, and the variety of contracts starts every day. The pick up this cash flow and track it down is really, really difficult. Then my question is, on the column C, on the page 13, the CSM balance of group 2 shows 761. This is because this contract in itself is somehow negative cash flow, because interest rate went down to 1%, but you have to still pay 2%. So many insurers says they internally carry forward this negative CSM, so that they want to track what was the actual cash flow of each contract, and amortize based on this negative cash flow only internally, because it is not allowed IFRS 17 to carry forward. But the outcome for this mutualization group of contract is almost same as the transferring cash flow of 906. If you look at the detail, then outcome could be different, but they think it is more beneficial for them to manage their own contract, because that provides better information to know that group two itself was a negative CSM. So do you think it's possible to do that internally for the insurer to do that? And arguing that it would say it will come up with almost same outcome.
Well, you're right. I mean, IFRS 17 does not tell people how to do these calculations, and there are bits in the standard that say, B70 says that you can do your identify your fulfillment cash flows at one level, and then you need to make appropriate allocations to the groups, and the reason for spelling out, the calculations in this example is just so that people could, be sure that we worked through some numbers and that we knew what we were talking about. I mean, all I would say is that the point we're making is that IFRS 17, if you look at column C, IFRS 17 correctly identifies that is not the right outcome to get to that negative CSM, to portray Group 2 as onerous, because we agree with the people who tell us, and we agree with this, that issuing those contracts in Group 2 is not bad for the entity. It increases the return, the entity share of the returns. So, and IFRS 17 tells you not to do what's in column C, but to do instead what is in column D. And that shows you the entity share, the CSM, that we wish to be recognized over the period that the contracts in Group 1 and in Group 2 have coverage. And that is the sort of point of the example. But how you do that, exactly how you set up your systems to get to that answer, is for entities to find the best way of doing.
Maybe having heard from lots of insurer, it might be easier to carry forward this negative CSM internally, so that they can amortize as it is, and then see the total outcome, knowing that the column D is the best calculation. So that is what they want. I was wondering whether it provide the correct outcome or not. But such kind of way has a benefit, because they know each individual contract, and they can manage each individual contract by knowing that what is the negative CSM internally, and what is the balance of negative CSM. And then they can aggregate based on the mutualization, rather than transferring artificial cash flow in the cash flow column. So, yeah,
well,
that's what I have.
I'm not sure I call the artificial cash flows, and I think the point that Anna's making is that that's an implementation issue, not something for the standard.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you.
Daryl? So a couple of things, I guess. A starting point, I think this is one of the biggest issues that we're thinking about. I think it is because it goes to the core of the benefits of the standard. And so I fully accept, and I think we've had the opportunity during outreach to hear plenty of times that this is a costly exercise, and I think Tuck is correct in identifying some of the costs that might exist. At the same time, I think that the benefits that come from the standard are driven in large part by this particular, so I support where the staff have landed on this. Are those worth picking up on a couple of words that Tuck used, because I think these are important. I do think it's critical from my perspective, and I've heard from a number of different insurers that they have a number of different approaches that they are using to achieve the outcomes. And I think I hope it's common sense around the world, but clearly the examples that we use in the IFRSs are about the examples we use in these papers are about us from a board perspective understanding what the underlying issue is. But these examples should never be seen, I think, as the mechanism you have to use to get to that answer. So I think that's really important. So I just thought there were two things that I wanted to pick up on what you said. I think the first one is when you're talking about insurers managing multiple contracts, and I agree that for some insurers the multiple contract point is the starting point for what they do. But I do think that's where the level of grouping that we are permitting within the standard becomes really important, because it's not going to be on a contract-by-contract basis, but rather on a group-by-group basis. And I think that provides significant relief already in terms of the process. The other thing that I would caution against is the negative CSM. And again, I've also heard from a number of insurers who believe that they would like to track negative CSM, and I think that's very useful from an internal perspective. But I think applying negative CSM in this particular circumstance without anything else will produce a different outcome. Mm-hmm. And perhaps the easiest way to look at that is to look at the table in paragraph 42. Essentially, if you were only using the negative CSM number for group two, when you get to year six, you're going to have a very funny outcome, because it would seem like you've only got negative CSM left to release. And if I wind that back, that indicates to me that my CSM is actually going to be wrong for every period if it's wrong for that one. So I do think that while you might want to keep track of the underlying negative CSM, you're going to have a methodology for allocating the CSM across the periods, however that might actually be achieved.
Agreed. Nick?
So I support staff proposals here to retain the requirements in respect of the level of aggregation. To me, this is one of the central elements, if not a critical element, of our proposals. As I've said before, many investors have stepped back from analysing the sector on a fundamental basis. Some have stepped back from the sector altogether. And there are a number of reasons for that, but one of those is the difficulty of comparing one entity to another. Now, without a consistent level of aggregation on an identical, I'm trying not to use the word group or portfolio, let's say on an identical set of contracts, there's a potential for different profit recognition over time, a different profile of profit recognition. And this is particularly important in these circumstances, one, because of the long duration of contracts in the insurance sector, and secondly, perhaps what's not always recognised, is the change in the nature of mandates managed by the investment management industry, by investors. So if we go back, you know, a few decades ago, investors were mostly focused on managing single country domestic portfolios, probably easier to deal with issues of comparability there. Today, many, if not the majority of portfolios, are either international or global, and hence the requirement for greater comparability from financial statements has actually gone up significantly. And to me, without a consistent level of aggregation, it undermines comparability or allows the potential for these different profit profiles over time from identical sets of contracts. So I accept there is a cost to this, albeit it may be a short-term cost, because I think there are benefits both to investors and also to insurers. You start to bring investors back to the sector, this will obviously reduce the cost of capital for the sector. And I think we need to focus on those long-term benefits. So I'm strongly in favour of retaining the existing requirements.
And prepares will get better, more granular management information.
Yeah.
Sue?
First thing I'd like to say is I think that this series of papers, A, B and C, is a really useful series of papers because I think it's really helpful to remind us of the journey that we've been on. And I think it's also really important. I think it's, for me, the clearest articulation I've seen us produce of why we've got the approach that we have and why it matters to us. It's this idea about trends and profitability. We talk a lot about onerous contracts, but that's not all that we care about. And I think that these set of papers, hopefully, even if people don't agree with where they are, it helps understand what it was that we're aiming for, and therefore I think it supports the, you know, conclusion, which I agree with, that we shouldn't change anything here. Hopefully it helps in that process. And I think it's really important to remember that we ended up here trying to be helpful. I think now people tell us all the time about how costly and onerous it is, and I know that there's lots of systems changing on this, but we landed up here after going through a very thorough process, including doing some field testing with people, where I was in meetings where they made a very convincing case for the costs of the proposals that we had when we were focusing on similar profitability. So we were trying to still get the sort of information we thought was helpful for investors, which I still think is helpful for investors, but in a way that was providing some assistance to the industry. And I think it's really important to note that even though we say here in paragraph 16 that it makes sure that you don't end up recognising losses even when claims in a profitable group are developing exactly as expected in the banking industry, if you get the losses you expect, you still have to recognise impairment losses, expected credit losses, because we don't allow grouping in other industries. So we've already tried to reflect this risk-sharing concept, even with the requirements that we have today. And the other thing I wanted to just touch on is the example that we've now got in paragraph in a paper 2A. And I think it's really helpful that we had a group that was willing to put the time in and send us a specific example.
Yeah.
They put a lot of effort and a lot of work in it. And for me, it really helped me articulate better what it is we're trying to get from the requirements and how they work. And I think it really facilitates a good analysis. I think it's a really helpful exercise that they put this forward.
Yeah.
Now, I'm sure they might be looking at this paper and being disappointed that we weren't convinced that that meant that there was something wrong. But I think it's really helpful because at least now when we have a discussion with people about this issue, we're not going to be talking so much at cross purposes because we're talking about the same example and we can really compare and contrast what we're trying to achieve versus what they were thinking. And I think that's a really useful exercise. And the thing that it really shows to me, if you look at following Anne's suggestion, the table on page 13, is that it does, our requirements do reflect the relationship between these groups by showing an adjustment in the CSM. So we are acknowledging that there is a difference between a situation where there isn't this sharing between groups.
Yes.
We are reflecting that, but we still think it's really important to understand where profits are coming from, so it matters to us what the effect is to the profit of the entity on CSM as well.
Yeah.
And by not averaging the profit overall, which is what they are suggesting would be good, we're getting this more granular information that you can see in D, which shows the fact that actually there's a different profitability coming to the entity as a result of these arrangements, and we care about that. We don't just care about whether it's onerous overall. We really care about these profitability trends. So I think this is a really, really important example, which I hope moves us forward, because at least we're talking, not hopefully at cross purposes anymore. We might still not agree, but I think we're in a much better position to debate.
Jen Chow.
Thank you, Anne. First of all, I support the staff's proposal. As Sue mentioned, that I really appreciate the paper 2A, 2B, and 2C, especially the examples given to us really help us to understand why we need the requirements about level aggregation, especially about the annual cohort requirement. I think if without this requirement, maybe we will end up that maybe some insurance company only have one group, because if they only provide one single product line. So I think the objective of this insurance contract standard will not be achieved, because why we need these standards, we try to provide transparent information of those insurance contracts. And the main point is that we try to open the box to let all the people know that what's inside this box. If the level of aggregation is too high, it will hide a lot of things. I think users will not benefit with about implement IFRS 17. So I really supported the staff's proposal. Secondly, with regard to tax concern, originally, when I go through this the example, I also have similar concern as you have. But when I'm thinking about that, the underlying concept of this project, all the insurance accounting treatment should be based on the contractual right and obligation. That means it should be based on the contractor terms. If the terms, including the intergenerational sharing of returns, the accounting treatment should be based on those terms, should reflect those sharing of returns. So that means that even based on the paragraph, the example given on the paragraph on the page 13, that's the C proposal, it sounds like Group C, the CSM is lost, you know, but actually part of that loss shared by the Group 1, based on the contractor terms. So in order to faithfully represent the contractor terms, contractual rights and obligation, I agree with the current requirement of IFRS 17. It's exactly consistent with our basic underlying concept of insurance accounting treatment.
Just can I quickly respond on the all of what you said, but the question is, if you follow the contractual term of each group, I think C itself is the right amount for each group, especially about cash flow itself. But because we have to clarify the CSM amount, we transfer cash flow as of 906 from Group 1 to Group 2. That is the column D. That is my understanding. So if you just follow the idea of the contract by contract, I mean the Group 1's contract and the Group 2's contract is different, and then the cash flow for that group is only 10828 is correct, and Group 2 for 15761 is correct. But if we just simply follow, then Group 2 would be negative CSM. Therefore, we transfer the cash flow from Group 1 to Group 2. That is what I thought artificial. And the outcome is the same. The total CSM is 676 anyway. So the only the difference is the allocation of CSM, Group 1 and Group 2. And they are mutualized. So therefore, it doesn't really matter. But internally, whether or not having negative CSM or make it artificially positive is beneficial, depends on the entity.
So could I just say, we don't think it's an artificial transfer. We think it is reflecting the fact that some of the cash flows that are paid to the policyholders in Group 2, but they exist because of the contracts in Group 1. And we don't think that's artificial. And we're not doing that just because, we want to avoid onerous contracts where things are mutualized. We're doing it because we are following the principles of identifying the cash flows that arise out of the contracts in the group with that group. So I don't think it's right to say it's an artificial transfer. It's just correctly identifying the cash, which cash flows belong to which group.
I'm not very sure because the Group 1's contract in itself is like it is written in here, with the stakeholder of Group 1 and the stakeholder is Group 2 is different.
Well, the amounts going to the policyholders are exactly like they are in column C, but some of that amount that goes to the Group 2 policyholders only exists because of the contract in Group 1. And therefore, we say those cash flows belong to the contracts in Group 1. Now, they're paid to the policyholders in Group 2, but that was a very deliberate and important part of how IFRS 17 sets up the fulfilment cash flows for each group.
And I think possibly there are a couple of important things which I would agree completely are specific to this example. Yeah. So the first thing that's happening in this example is that the contractual terms of the example allow for the entity to essentially take money away from Group 1 and give it to Group 2. Yeah. The other thing that's important here is the context of adding these contracts in Group 2 actually does make the company better off.
Yeah, of course.
And so what you don't want to reflect is by adding this additional amount, I now have, instead of 10,000 under management, I have 25,000 under management, and that 25,000 under management gives me a better return.
Yeah.
So it is not an onerous contract. It's a contract in which the entity is better off, but it is better off because the terms of the contract allow me to take from A to give to B. If the terms of the contract didn't allow that, then I don't think this treatment is correct because then it would be net onerous for the entity taking this contract on.
So it's reflecting the real contractual deal.
Yeah.
Exactly,
this is the real economics important. That's being reflected.
Martin.
Thanks, Hans. And first I want to say thank you to the staff that we have now the three papers which we have in one place for all the arguments and the history why we came to this standard and especially why we came to the annual cohorts. So having said that, I think for me that is really comes to the core of the benefits of our standard because we wanted to improve comparability insurance industry with others and give a better insight into the performance of these entities. And I think this demonstrates if we don't would have this kind of level of aggregation, if it would be higher, then I think we will lose it. Many people or stakeholders say, okay, that we have not understood the business because the business is pooling of risk, and then the only way to show profitability is also to pooling that. I totally disagree with that. And if you, for example, look at other industries, when I'm coming from the banking industry and looking at retail loans, for me, retail loans is also pooling of risk. You also don't know, okay, which kind of loan will go sour and which will not. And therefore, the business model is pooling of credit risk. And then you also charge the same risk premium, which is then the credit spread in the interest rate to all the same customers. But nobody in the banking industry would say the only good reflection of our business model is that we take all this kind of interest rates of different years when I have done that and then pooling that and take it out and then show my profitability. So that is not unique to that business. I think that is kind of what in other industries where it's the same kind of business model, which is risk pooling, then, okay, they have accepted that, and I think it is better reporting, because otherwise I think it is a big mishmash of certain probabilities and they're taking out whatever they want. And therefore, I think why we wanted to do this project was to improve on that, and Nick made it transparent, say, okay, that is why we heard from investors, we don't invest in this industry because it is not transparent, the profitability is not transparent. And if we give up on that, I think then people will challenge the overall benefits of our standard, why are we doing that? And I agree, that is a lot of cost which may be involved to do that, but I think the benefits outweigh this cost. And if we give up on these benefits, then we're getting the next round of argument, people saying, no, the overall cost is now not relying with the benefits. And I think that is really why I think this paper really summarized that and give the reasons why we have done it. It was not that we... Maybe people say, okay, this one annual cohort is not the best. Yeah, I agree. But this explains the history why we came up to that. And I still think, okay, that is now the best compromise that we can find and reflects and achieves what we wanted to have with benefits more comparable, my example, with the banking industry and better insight into performance. Therefore, I agree with the staff recommendation. Don't change that.
Mary.
I don't think I can match Martin's passion, but agree with his conclusion. I had actually a lot of hesitation about us including the level of aggregation and the list of issues we were considering. I think it was necessary for us to do so, given the feedback we'd heard, particularly by the TRG, about the significance. But to me, looking again at that really risks, you know, a fundamental reconsideration of the standard. So I was very hesitant about how we were going to approach this. And as Martin said, a series of three papers is not only a good history lesson in context, but I think it very much enhanced by the example. And I want to echo what Sue said about how helpful and insightful the example is and how well the staff has used it here. Because one of the things that really brought home to me is that something that we have done elsewhere in IFRS is not applicable here. And that thing is there are times, and I don't know whether it holds up, where we say, here's the issue. You can adjust for it here, or you can adjust for it here as long as you get to, you know, the outcome. And I'm thinking, for example, about IAS 37 and risk of uncertainty, whether it's in the cash flows or the discount rate. What this proves, and what working through it, is it matters whether you adjust it in the fulfillment cash flows or the CSM. And the point is that because the insurance model that we have is asymmetrical for the CSM, because losses for onerous contracts are recognized immediately while profits are spread over time. And so what the staff has illustrated here is why, you know, one of the things that's illustrated, brought together, is that, you know, you, as Daryl said, we are not prescribing you must do it this way, but one of the things this brings out is why you must adjust it in fulfillment cash flows when there is mutualization of the sharing of returns, rather than saying, I can just do it by pooling and averaging the CSM. And so that's a very important lesson that is made by these examples. And something else that I wanted to highlight, if you look at paragraph A13 on page 23, and this goes to Martin's point about profitability, we, you know, our standard is focused not just on liability adequacy, but also showing the performance in different periods. And to me, one of the anchors of that is that the profit for a group of contracts is recognized over the life of the group of contracts. And as we see here, if we combined the two groups here, what you'd see in year six, the combined group CSM of 85 is actually a big, you know, a piece of that is the profitability on the group that expired in year Y5. Yeah. And so if we are, you know, to reflect, we have in this example, with the total of annual cohorts, the line above, fully reflected the mutualization of returns on the assets in the fulfillment cash flows, so that mutualization is reflected. But we also managed to show that there are different profitabilities associated with the two groups of contracts, and we've recognized the margin in the periods in which the groups are outstanding. And to me, that is another central anchor that we're seeing here. Now, this example was concerned only really with differences in returns. Groups could have differences in other characteristics that would also show up in fulfillment cash flows. And again, if we were merging the CSMs, we might distort other performance information. So I think the example is incredibly helpful in illustrating some key anchors, including what you have to put in fulfillment cash flows and what you put through CSM and the interaction. And as others have said, the adjustment of the fulfillment cash flows does have an impact on the CSM, but it doesn't force the recognition of Group 1 CSM into a year when there are no longer Group 1 contracts outstanding.
Jung-woo.
I agree with the staff's recommendation. The paper is very nice, and Daryl explained very well on the paragraph 42. That's a kind of a specific picture of why annual cohort requirement is necessary. But to have a kind of fair discussion on this issue with our stakeholders, we need to, I'd like to check some kind of things. First thing is, based on this paragraph in 38, a summary of the table, everything,
basically our requirement of B67 and B71. That's a kind of a requirement to account kind of mutual effect in our model. So that accounting requirement of B67 and 71 deals with some kind of onerous position of group two in the example, right? So our annual quota requirement plays a role in the periodic allocation, as Tak said, and a periodic allocation of from year one to year six. So in this case, annual quota requirements helps us to get a more precise profit over periods. So that's very, very well explained in 42. But I'm wondering, I understand we are getting a more precise periodic performance from this annual quota requirement. But if we just modify this example, and group one and group two have the same period, year one, year two, five. The in that case, in a periodic performance of year two and year six, especially year six is disappearing because both groups of one and two have their period of year one and year five. So in that case, annual quota requirement might lose some kind of a, but still we are providing precise periodic performance. However, the benefit might be reduced if we use a different example.
Well, that is true, and it is true that, if you, by using annual cohorts rather than using what we proposed in when we tried to do a principle-based approach where we were getting similar probability and the same duration and everything, that, so annual cohorts are a practical expedient, and that means that if you have in your annual cohorts the extent to which you have different duration contracts coming up either in annual cohorts or across annual cohorts, that would give you different answers from if you were doing it a completely principle-based approach. But even if everything had the same duration, so you didn't have this year six effect that we're picking up, you'd also need to think about the effect of the different profitability where you get changes in expectations, because group one is considerably more resilient than group two. So if there were a change in expectations, in this example, the only cash flows are those that relate to the underlying items. But in a more realistic example, you'd have some fixed cash flows like claims or a guarantee or something. And in that case, changes in expectations could make group two onerous much more quickly than it could group one. And so that also is information that we wouldn't want to lose. So, yes, you're right. Ideally, we would have come up with a principle-based approach which would have focused on exactly what we wanted, but that was thought to be too onerous. This is a practical expedient, but it still is giving a lot of the useful information we need.
Françoise.
Well, I agree with a lot of what has been said so far. I also support the staff recommendation. I would like to highlight that, the set of papers has been helpful. To me, I would have been open to consider alternative to the annual quotas, provided that those who would have come with those alternatives would have demonstrated that the method that would put forward would meet the objective of reflecting profitability period to period. So to me, there was no possibility of compromising with the objective because, if we compromise on that one, I don't know what we're doing here. The example in the paper about the policyholders who fully share the same risks has been very important to me because I think it's an area where I had my doubts at some stage. And I think it fully demonstrates that the economics of the interrelationships between the various generations of contract is taken into account by IFRS 17, is well reflected. So it's not as if with annual quotas, we were preventing that economic feature to be reflected. So it's fully reflected. And it shows, as you said, Anne, when you presented, that you demonstrated that there was individualism in the generation of profit. And in fact, if you consider that you have to take into account group one and group two, because they're basically, by managing the pool of assets, you are serving the entire population, then I think that the list is endless, because you should also take group three, which are not yet subscribed. Because you're serving that next population as well. So there is no reason why, you know, the supplementary subscribers would be taken into account on that ground. So that has been extremely helpful to me. Thank you, and I support.
Sure.
I just wanted to, I forgot to make this comment before. It was sort of partly reflecting on the comments made very early in the discussion about the sort of mechanics and whether you have to do things the way that is set out here. And we already have a basis paragraph in 17 which comments on the fact that you don't have, I can't remember what the words are, but the gist of it is that you don't have to use the annual cohorts sort of so strictly as long as the outcome is the same, something along those lines. And I think that is important, that we're not sort of dictating bookkeeping, if you like, or exactly how you have to set up your systems. But I think this paper is really, really important to be clear what we mean in terms of what the outcome is meant to be. So if you decide you don't need to do annual cohorts because you're going to get the same outcome as column E, then you can't do that.
Yeah.
And so I think that this paper is also helpful in terms of clarifying what it is you're aiming for. And to Chung Wu's point as well in your response, and the fact that even if the durations were the same, if you've got these differences in profitability, you still need to have an eye on what's going on in the annual cohorts, because otherwise you're not faithfully actually going to achieve what it is that we're trying to get through the recognition requirements in the standard.
Well, I would like to add to the compliments the staff for this very clear set of papers. I think the papers make crystal clear with these concrete examples that if we do not stick to the annual cohorts, there will remain almost unlimited possibilities for unfettered averaging of profits. That's something that was also normal for the rest of the economy, let's say 15, 20 years ago. Everybody's happy that that is over. And I think the insurance industry will in the future also be happy that that is over and that profits will really show the performance of a company. Also, the fact that what was also said by Mary, the fact that if we don't do this, that it is possible that contracts will continue to contribute to profits long after they have expired. It simply doesn't make any sense. I talked to a CFO of an insurance company that was not aware that if we didn't do this, that this would continue to happen. And I think if people see these concrete examples, that every insurer must admit this is not right. And that has to stop. I do see that it will add to costs. Everybody acknowledges that. But just think about other industries with huge volumes of contracts, like banking, like the telecom industry. They have to do it all contract by contract. And at least the insurance industry can still work group by group. And yes, it will lead to increased costs, but the cost will probably be less than the accounting costs of banks and the telecom industry. So I would also say count your blessings a little bit. And then finally, I really think what I've said before, these proposals really contribute to financial stability, because profitability is the canary in the coal mine. If profitability goes down, it needs to be shown as quickly as possible, because it could be could mean that the company in question is getting into a lot of trouble, and the insurance industry is extremely important for financial stability. This needs to be shown. So I would really hope that there's a lot of resistance still against these proposals. I would hope that the requirement. Well, but I would really hope that the industry can accept this and live with it and make the best of it. Okay, can I see who supports the staff's recommendations?
14. Paper 2D discusses credit cards that meet the definition of an insurance contract because the entity issuing the credit card also provides insurance coverage to the card holder. The entity is providing insurance itself, so it is acting as a principal. Some stakeholders are concerned that in the circumstances where the entity is required to provide insurance by the regulation where the entity operates, the entity is required by IFRS 17 to account for the credit card contract as an insurance contract. Therefore, this paper focuses on circumstances where the entity cannot avoid providing insurance with the credit card. Entities issuing credit cards do not typically issue contracts in the scope of IFRS 17 and therefore are not focused on IFRS 17 implementation. To address stakeholders' concerns and to provide cost reliefs for those entities, the paper recommends amending IFRS 17 to exclude from the scope of the standard credit card contracts that provide insurance coverage for which the entity does not reflect an assessment of the insurance risk associated with an individual customer in setting the price of the contract with that customer. For the example of credit card discussed in the paper, this recommendation would result in a continuation of the existing practice of applying IFRS 9 to the loan or low commitment and any interest revenue in the credit card, and IFRS 15 to other services provided by the credit card, if any. An entity would need to consider which IFRS standard to apply to the insurance coverage provided. Because an insurance contract meets the definition of a financial instrument, an entity would, for example, apply IFRS 9 if the insurance coverage is part of the contractual terms, or IAS 37 if the insurance coverage is imposed by regulation. So I would now hand over to the board for the discussion of this paper.
Maru.
Thanks, Hans. Another excellent paper from the staff following the series of the UABC. And I would agree with staff proposal, particularly to approach to develop a specific scope exclusion. I would draw the attention to what I truly believe is a proper assessment of the issue. And as you stress in paragraph 21, the existing accounting for credit card do provide useful information. I think including this under the scope, this specific kind of credit card agreement, including under the scope of IFRS 17 would add costs without the benefit. So I do agree with staff in this particular aspect.
So.
I also agree with the staff's recommendation for a couple of reasons, even though it feels a little bit odd to scope something out of 17 where we're saying it does have insurance risk. I support this because, firstly, I think it's more likely than not that those who have already applied IFRS 9 have spent time and effort applying IFRS 9 to these contracts already, so that reduces disruption by allowing them to stay in IFRS 9. And also because I think that our standards outside 17 can cope with these contracts in an appropriate way, either within the scope of 9 or 9 plus 37, depending on, you know, the situation that we have in place. And so I think we still end up with useful information, and it's helpful, I think, for those involved in implementation.
Thank you. I agree with staff's recommendation. I just wanted to confirm couple of things which I have already asked in the private discussion, but I just want to reiterate in the public meeting. So on my credit card, on the back of my credit card, it says this card provides travel insurance. Does it mean it is out of the scope of IFRS 17?
I think that depends if the travel insurance is provided by the bank, in the credit cards, or is provided by a third party, like an insurer.
Right.
Because we think that in the market, most of the credit cards can sell insurance, but the bank is acting as an agent on behalf of another company.
Right.
So in that case, if the bank is acting as an agent, the travel insurance will not be in the scope of...
Okay, so the actually, if it's an agent working as an agent, if the credit card company is working as an agent, then the actual insurer is behind the credit card company. So those insurers' insurance is under the scope of IFRS 17, even if that doesn't provide assessment for the customer, that is not the problem because it is not come up with the credit card insurance. Right. Okay.
We'd have to assess it against scope exclusions in IFRS 17. So there are some, you would have to look at the scope exclusions of IFRS 17, but it's likely it would be within the scope.
Okay, good. Thank you.
For the actual insurance. For the actual insurance.
So a couple of things. I think I'm in the same place as the others who've spoken. I agree with where we have the outcome that we get by applying the recommendation in the paper. There were a couple of reasons for that. Firstly, and I just agree with what others have said, that I think that the other standards provide appropriate accounting. I think people have gone through the effort. So for those reasons, I'm comfortable with where we've landed on the standard. There were a couple of things that I sort of thought about as I was getting towards the conclusion. I think the first one was, although some of those who raised this issue with us originally were operating in a regulated environment, we have not included that in the recommendation. And I'm comfortable with that outcome because I think that the economics of these contracts are similar whether they arise from regulation or not from regulation. And so I think the issue is consistent across both of those groups. And when this was first brought to my attention as an issue to consider, I went through a whole lot of loops to try and figure out how I'd go about defining what a credit card type of transaction, what a credit card is without using the words credit card. And I think I went through the ideas of something like a financial instrument where the primary objective is providing transactional services and potentially credit, but this is incidental to that primary purpose. When the paper came out and staff used the word credit card, it almost seemed like too easy a simplification to get to. But I think this is good because I think it addresses exactly the problem that we have heard about. And I think because of that, I think it allows us to move on quite quickly and quite logically. So I support where we have landed on this.
Tom?
Just a small point. In paragraph 39, on the permit require, the main reason to reject permit, quote the last few words, in practice, in the absence of evidence, entities issue credit card contracts, provide insurance coverage, also issue other insurance contracts. I'm happy with that. If you were to uncover evidence on exposure that was not the case, that there are people out doing both, would we be inclined to go to permit or would we stick with require?
It depends on what evidence is provided at the time and what
I'm
they
saying,
say.
Suppose there were that, because that would just suppose there were quite a few people popped up and said, "Here we are."
I think just the fact of it is not enough. We have to look at the underlying and the reasons why.
Okay, because that was my question. The most of the explanation relied on they don't exist, and whether we want to. That's why I just want to look down the road and make sure if they suddenly exist that we know what we want to do.
If it suddenly exists, we'd look at where and why and when and how and lots of questions and take it from there.
So, I think it's a fair question, but if we were to come back and have that situation, I think we'd need to think carefully about the information as well, because for the types of contracts that at least I have in my head based on the outreach I've done and the specific issue that's been identified, I think the primary risk we'd still be thinking about accounting for would be credit risk, and IFRS 9, I think, deals with that pretty well. So I think we'd need to think about the consequences of allowing a choice of going into 17 as well for the product.
Yeah.
to. Oh, sorry.
You can vote.
Can you vote?
Yep. Assuming this is in favour.
Yes.
Paper 2F, then?
E.
2E, sorry, I'm jumping. Okay, paper 2E, transition requirements and the risk mitigation option. This is a follow-up paper. So at the February board discussion, the board considered stakeholders' concern that the risk mitigation option can only be used prospectively from the date of initial application of IFRS 17, even though risk mitigation activities may have been in place before that date. The board considered both the possible distortion of the contractual service margin on transition that will be allocated to profit in future periods and the equity on transition, as well as the impact on comparative reporting periods. The board at that meeting tentatively decided to retain the prohibition in IFRS 17 of retrospective application of the risk mitigation option and asked the staff to explore alternative proposals that would address stakeholders' concerns. The staff have provided the analysis included in the agenda paper as requested by the board and recommended two amendments to IFRS 17 to address those concerns. So I'm going to introduce them separately and you can discuss them separately as well. So the first proposal included in question one is about prospective application of the risk mitigation option from the transition date. The staff recommends that the board should amend the requirements of IFRS 17 to permit an entity to apply the risk mitigation option prospectively from the transition date, provided that an entity designate its risk mitigation relationship to apply the risk mitigation option no later than the transition date of IFRS 17. We think this approach would eliminate the accounting mismatches with respect to the comparative periods. Given its nature, prospective application, it could be applied without the use of hindsight or risking cherry picking, and it would not disrupt implementation processes already underway. So with that, I hand over to the board to discuss our first recommendation.
Yeah, I'm very happy with this paper because when we discussed it the last two times, I was not happy that we would not allow prospective application for that, because I thought if companies who have done risk mitigation in the past, then in the future their results would not show that and would be kind of impacted by accounting, which I was not happy with. But I also understood, okay, that we could not allow it because this cherry-picking stuff. And I think that is now a solution, I think, which can help. And it's not perfect, but it's a solution, I think, which achieve both. One is, okay, that they can, especially in the comparative period, have the applying risk mitigation, which I think is essential because we make a big deal out of comparative because we said, okay, users need that because we have a big change and therefore do have at least one comparative period. And this comparative period is not distorted by, I think, this accounting mismatch. Therefore, we're allowing that, which is good. And secondly, okay, then also the CSM for the future is not impacted if they can use this by this risk mitigation. So I'm supporting staff recommendation, and I'm really happy that you have brought that back and we have found a solution for that.
Thank you, Hans. As Martin said, I also agree with staff's proposal. I think there are two benefits very clear. One is that it will help the insurance company to provide really comparable information, because those financial information prepared provided in the comparable period and the information provided at the current period, they will be based on the consistent basis. I think this is one of the benefits. Second benefit is that we try to avoid that avoid some unnecessary accounting mismatch, because they already done some risk mitigation, but the financial statement did not reflect this kind of effect. So I think I agree with staff's proposal. Once we provide this kind of option, those two benefits could be achieved. It's helpful to provide useful information to the users.
So
I'm also supportive of this. I think it helps relative to where we are today. I think we need to be careful not to oversell it because it's not the equivalent of full retrospective application, but I think it is helpful, and for that reason I would support it.
Can I see who supports that recommendation?
14. So we've split the discussion, although some of your comments, I think, were relevant also to the second question. I'll just go quickly introduce this, and then you'll have another chance to reflect your thoughts on this. So the other bit of this paper is in question two, permitting entities that are affected by the prohibition to apply the fair value approach. So the prospective application of the risk mitigation option addresses the concerns about the comparative periods. However, on its own, only that, it does not address the concern about the possible distortion in the CSM and in the equity on transition day. This is why in the second part of the paper we introduce another recommendation. And to address that concern, the staff recommended the board should amend the requirements of IFRS 17 to permit an entity that can apply IFRS 17 retrospectively to a group of insurance contracts with direct participation feature to use the fair value transition approach for a group if they meet those criteria. So A, choose to apply the risk mitigation option to a group prospectively from the transition date, and B, have used derivatives or insurance contract held to mitigate financial risk arising from a group before the transition date. The staff observed that introducing additional optionality, even if limited by those criteria, may decrease comparability between entities on transition. However, the staff think that this is an acceptable compromise given the information provided. Applying the fair value approach to transition provides useful information in those circumstances. So I hand it over to you to see if you have additional comments.
Mary.
Just one question about the example in here. I overall supportive of the staff recommendation, but paragraph 25 gives an example of a contract that is characterized as a variable fee contract, and the characteristic that you're focused on is the minimum return guarantee of 2%. I struggle, and I just wanted to confirm that you view this as an example of a variable fee contract that happens to have a 2% return rather than a contract that is variable fee because it has a 2%.
No. So okay. This is a variable fee contract that happens to have that guarantee. Okay. That can happen.
Yeah. Daryl.
I agree with the decision. I agree with you. I want to confirm just a wordy thing. The question says approach for the group if they. Now, I think what we mean from the context of the rest of the document is, and I've never quite understood why we use these words, but if and only if.
Yes.
In other words, you have to have these requirements.
Yes.
It's not a...
Yes.
So that's the first thing. So the second part is just to say I support this because I think if I look at the reason why we are introducing this in the first place, it's because we have a concern that arises in specific issues where the board was concerned about cherry-picking. Without these two, I think we create the opportunity for cherry-picking again. So I think what this does is it restricts it to that space where it makes sense and only to that space where it makes sense. So I agree with where you've landed.
I agree with the staff proposal because I had concerns about the discussion we have in relation to question one for the reasons similar to Martin, that we're imposing some accounting that doesn't capture some reality that has gone on before that transition date. So we've made that decision to propose the change to allow the retrospective accounting to happen from the transition date, which goes some way towards the issue, but not all of it. So I think by doing this as well, that adds to improving the information that will be available. So I do support what we're proposing for question two as well.
Just to comment one thing, we don't look at this as allowing retrospective application for 1 year. We actually look at it as prospective from transition date because the designation is very important for us in terms of cherry picking. So just the use of the words.
Yes.
Thank you.
Can I see who supports the second recommendation?
14. Thank you.
So we now move on to agenda paper 2F, which considers transition requirements for loans that meet the definition of insurance contract. These loans are currently in the scope of IFRS 4 and will be in the scope of IFRS 17. As a reminder, the board tentatively decided last February to amend the scope of IFRS 17 and IFRS 9 to permit an entity to apply either IFRS 17 or IFRS 9 to such contracts. The paper discusses specific transition requirements as a result of this tentative decision. I'm going to introduce question 1 to 3 first. The question is about whether the board should amend the transition requirement of the standards. And I would then introduce question 4 to 7, which are about how to amend the relevant requirements. With respect to whether the board should amend the transition requirements, we recommend that the board should not consider specific transition requirements in two cases. The first case is when an entity elects to apply IFRS 17 to a portfolio of loans. The second case is when an entity elects to apply IFRS 9 to such loans and the entity applies IFRS 17 and IFRS 9 at the same time. This is because in such circumstances, an entity would apply the existing transition requirement in IFRS 17 or IFRS 9 to the loans. We think those requirements are sufficient. However, we recommend the board amend the transition requirement in IFRS 9 when an entity elects to apply IFRS 9 to loans that transfer significant insurance risk and the entity has applied IFRS 9 before it initially applies IFRS 17. This is because the entity would have already transitioned to IFRS 9 and thus would not be permitted to apply the transition requirement in IFRS 9. I will now hand over for discussion on a recommendation set out in question 1 to 3 of the paper.
Do we agree?
It's so compelling.
But I have to compliment the analysis because it's an incredibly, incredibly technical area and it was very impressive and thorough.
Yes.
Here, here. I was also very impressed.
With respect now to how to amend the transition requirement in IFRS 9, we have to consider in our analysis the requirements that the board should set out in similar circumstances. In particular, we consider the requirements in paragraphs C29 to C33 of IFRS 17 on the redesignation of financial assets when an entity initially applies IFRS 17, as well as the requirements on prepayment fetcher with negative compensation in IFRS 9. Our recommendations are consistent with those existing requirements. So our recommendations are included in question 4 to 7 of the paper, and I will hand over to the board for discussion on our recommendation. So maybe we can call a global vote. So we on question 4, 5, 6, and 7, whether you agree with our recommendation.
14. Very good. Very convincing analysis.
Okay, so we'll see if that paper will go so smoothly as well. So agenda paper 2G discusses the proposed changes to the disclosure requirements as a result of the board's tentative decisions to amend IFRS 17. There are two areas considered in this paper for which the staff recommend changes. And I'm planning to discuss those areas and ask questions on them separately. The first topic relates to the tentative decisions to recognize contractual service margin in profit or loss on the basis of insurance coverage and investment-related services or investment return services. Because the release pattern could become more subjective and complex as a result of that decision, the staff recommend the board to amend two existing disclosures in IFRS 17 related to contractual service margin. First is to require quantitative information about the expected release of the contractual service margin in profit or loss in future periods. This means removing the option to provide qualitative information currently available in IFRS 17. The second one is to require specific disclosure of the approach of assessing the relative weightings between the different types of services. Now, question one on page 7 asks whether the board agree with the staff recommendation, and I would like to hand over to the board now to discuss the staff recommendation and ask any questions you may have.
Amaru.
Thank you, Hans.
Just, I agree with your proposal, but it's just to confirm because this is the word used here. So I do agree that will be helpful to provide this quantitative additional disclosure. But you argue in paragraph 13 that staff do not think that providing quantitative information will be burdensome because such information should be available for them. So my impression is that would be available for them because I have the impression that they would need this to really perform the model as required. Can I understand this way?
This is correct. So in order to allocate the CSM, you are using coverage units. Coverage units include the level of benefit and duration. This is one leg of coverage units. In order to determine how much you recognize in this period and how much is remaining, you need to know what is the expected duration. You need to know the level of benefits. So you should have that information. So we didn't think this is an additional burden or not a significant one.
Thank you.
Darryl.
So I agree with the recommendation. It's another wordy thing, I'm sorry to say. We say, i.e., removing the option of providing qualitative information. Now, in the context, I think what we mean there is that you will not be able to provide qualitative information instead of quantitative information. There's nothing to stop you providing quality.
Yes, of course.
Provide only.
You can provide as much as you want. No.
Did everyone catch that drafting suggestion?
Yes. Okay, who supports the staff recommendation?
14. So the second topic relates to the tentative decisions on the insurance acquisition cash flows for renewals outside of the contract boundary. Those cash flows will be recognized as assets and tested for impairment until they are included in the measurement of insurance contracts when those contracts are recognized. The proposed amendment might make such an asset of significant value and remain on the statement of financial position for a long period. So the staff recommend the board to require two additional disclosures. One is the reconciliation of the acquisition cash flows assets from the opening to closing balance to explain changes that occurred in the current period, especially those related to impairment. And the second disclosure is the quantitative information about when the entity expects this asset will be included in the measurement of related insurance contracts. Now, question two on page 12 asks whether the board agrees with the staff recommendation, and I would like to hand over to you for discussion and any questions.
Mary.
Just a quick observation that I think it's absolutely necessary that we go back, and look at the disclosure requirements, and I think you brought the right proposals forward, because my understanding is that this is likely to be a material asset in many, if not most, instances. And so thinking again about amending not just the recognition and measurement requirements, but also the disclosure to provide information is critical. So good work on following it through.
Can we support staff's recommendation?
14.
Okay, last paper. Roberta.
Last paper on insurance for today is paper H. The purpose of this paper is to ensure that we have considered the implication for disclosure and transition requirements of the tentative decision to amend IFRS 17. For each decision, the paper discusses whether, in the staff view, disclosure and transition requirements are sufficient or any action is needed. Except for the topics considered in agenda papers 2E and 2F for risk mitigation and loans that meet the definition of insurance contract, and agenda paper 2G for disclosure about the contractual service margin and acquisition cash flows that the board has just discussed, we have not identified any other need to amend the transition and disclosure requirements in IFRS 17. So we ask whether you agree with this staff analysis. And the question for the board is set out on page 15 of the paper. So I would hand over to you for the discussion.
Do we agree?
14. Thank you very much.
All right, thank you. So I suggest we take a break until 10 past 11.